Hello, you're listening to Sarah Jackman. On the 11th of February, the RICS published its new code on leasing business premises, which it hopes will improve the process of lease negotiations, making them fairer and more transparent. The code comes into force on the 1st of September, which gives practitioners 6 months to familiarise themselves with its detail and to prepare for implementation. Here to discuss the code with me is Warren Gordon, a senior professional support lawyer in the real estate team at CMS. Warren is a member of the RICS's working party on the code. Many thanks indeed for joining me today, Warren.
Good to be here.
We're going to have a chat today at the new code, which I know that you've been heavily involved in. Perhaps if we can start at the beginning. I know the code itself is evolved from previous iterations. How might practitioners have previously known it?
So the code's always been known as the Code for Leasing Business Premises, and it's been around for a very long time, dating all the way back to the mid-1990s. And at that time, the property industry was very anxious that the government, ironically a Tory government in this context, might legislate to outlaw upwards-only rent reviews in commercial leases. And the industry wanted to do something to show the government that it didn't need to act, and the code was the result, the output of that process. And whilst you can say that that original code was successful because the government didn't in fact legislate, the first couple of iterations of the code had little impact on behaviours in the negotiations over commercial leases and in relation to the content of leases. And the RICS, Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, was conscious of this and in 2007 relaunched the code to greater publicity. Now, it's true that the 2007 code over the following 13 years or so has been more influential and is perceived to be an exemplar of a balanced lease document, and some landlords have tried to make their leases more code compliant to varying degrees. Ultimately, however, the 2007 code didn't have a significant regulatory status for the RICS. That's a key aspect of the code that I'm sure we're going to talk about today. So a failure to comply had little impact on RICS members or organisations, and so more needed to be done. And the new code that was recently launched has been elevated to a more important level by becoming a professional statement.
Okay then, so some key changes. And can you just explain what's the rationale behind the code?
So the key rationale behind the new code is to improve the quality and fairness of lease negotiations and to promote the issue of comprehensive heads of terms. Heads of terms is a crucial impact and a crucial aspect of the new code. It's something we'll talk about later. And all of this is to enable the parties to the lease to make an informed decision about whether to proceed to enter into the lease on the terms that they negotiate. And whilst the code also includes a best practice section on the approach to and content of commercial leases, and also an informative supplemental guide for landlords and tenants, the key part of the code is the heads of terms and the approach to negotiations.
Okay, so you touched just now on the code receiving the status of professional statement. Just so that we're clear, can you explain a little bit about what that means?
So an RICS professional statement has a special dimension within the RICS list of hierarchy of documents. It's an important regulatory document for RICS members and organisations, and it includes mandatory aspects with which they must comply. And as I mentioned, there is this best practice section, which is not mandatory, but remains important in part because RICS members may be required by their regulatory body, the RICS, to justify non-compliance. And it's worth noting that the code talks about only exceptional circumstances when departures from best practice are appropriate. So best practice is important. It can't just be disregarded as far as this code is concerned. And professional statements are taken into account by the RICS in regulatory or disciplinary proceedings in deciding whether a member acted professionally and with reasonable competence.
Okay. Let's have a little look then at the actual detail of the code itself. What type of negotiations does it apply to? Does it apply to negotiations on all types of commercial premises, or are there some exclusions?
So I think it's important at this stage to create a whole context for the code. It's fundamentally worth remembering that the code is only mandatory for an RICS member or an RICS organisation. If a landlord, for example, is a property company or an institution to which the RICS doesn't regulate, then the code imposes no obligations on that landlord. And while such landlords may wish to comply with some or all of the code, there is no compulsion on them to do so. And this could lead to a challenging experience for an RICS member employed by a landlord that isn't regulated by the RICS and who can just choose to ignore the code. The reassurance for the regulated surveyor is that the mandatory parts, which really are the key things for the surveyor, as we will see, they're not especially contentious. Now, in terms of specifically the negotiations to which this applies, it applies to lettings of business premises in England and Wales, so it's not relevant to Scotland or to Northern Ireland, nor is it relevant to negotiations over lettings of residential space, it's purely for commercial. And most business premises are caught, but again, there are some exceptions. So it doesn't apply to premises used for housing plants and equipment, such as electronic communications apparatus, or to advertising hoardings, nor does it apply to premises intended to be wholly sublet by the tenant or for short-term lettings of not more than 6 months. But the bottom line is that most commercial lettings will be caught by the code, whether they are new leases or renewals of existing leases.
Okay. The code sets out a number of mandatory requirements for RICS members in relation to heads of terms. Can you explain what they are?
So there is a number of mandatory requirements, but it's only a small number. And as you say, they relate primarily to heads of terms and to negotiations. The first one is that lease negotiations must be approached in a constructive and collaborative manner. After all, negotiating a lease should not be a contentious situation. It should be the start or continuation of a commercial relationship between the landlord and the tenant, with the tenant gaining a suitable place to run his business and the landlord receiving rent, service charge and other benefits in return. So it's not a litigious matter. It should be something that is carried out constructively as the start of a commercial relationship. And an important element of the code is the party should be informed in the negotiation process and before entering into the lease. They should know what they're signing up to. And this is a particular concern where a party is not represented by a professional advisor. And to address this, the code requires an RICS member organisation where they're dealing with an unrepresented party to advise them about the existence of the code and also about the supplemental guide at the end of the code, which is a very informative section on points to bear in mind in relation to leases and the landlord-tenant relationship, and for the member to recommend to the unrepresented person that they should get independent professional advice.
Okay. And what does the code actually say on heads of terms?
So you've got to have written heads of terms that are subject to contract, that's typical, and they must summarise the position on a number of specified aspects of the proposed lease. And those particular issues include all of the topics typically encountered in heads of terms that are used on transactions today, such as identity of premises, how long is the lease, is it contracted out from sections 24 to 28 of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, what are the break rights for tenants or landlords, is there a guarantor or is a rent deposit required, what is the amount of the rent, is there a rent free or is there a rent review, what are the assignment, subletting and alteration rights, what use is permitted by the lease, and is service charge payable, and many others, but they're typical items that you would find in a set of heads of terms. And it's important to emphasise that whilst the mandatory element requires information to address certain lease aspects, it doesn't require any particular approach to be taken to that lease aspect. So whilst a break right has to be mentioned, i.e. there is a tenant's break right on a particular date, there are no mandatory requirements in relation to the contents of the break. So it doesn't say that certain preconditions, whether it's vacant possession or payment of rent, are permissible. That is to the parties to decide. The heads of terms just have to specify what the break rights actually are for that particular lease. And as I mentioned, these heads of terms requirements also apply to lease extensions and renewals, not just to new leases. But the code recognises that such leases may well follow the first lease, typically encountered on transactions today. But of course, there may be some reasonable modernisation allowed if the first lease was quite old. And these negotiations should aim to produce letting terms that achieve a fair balance between the parties. And the landlord or its letting agent will be responsible for ensuring that these compliant heads of terms are in place before the initial draft lease is circulated. And of course, whilst the mandatory requirement refers to the landlord, of course, as I say, there will be no compulsion if the landlord is not regulated by the RICS.
Okay. The code provides a template heads of terms that mirrors the code. Do you anticipate that this will become adopted as the norm, or are people more likely to rely on their own documentation being code compliant?
So you're correct that there is a full template heads of terms that is part of the code document. And the working party behind the code do hope the industry will find this a helpful document. However, there's a recognition that many landlords and their advisors already have their own template heads of terms, And rather than requiring them to change their particular forms, the code includes a separate checklist to ensure that existing forms satisfy its mandatory requirements. So I think going forward, some people will use the new template and some will continue to use their existing form, modified where required by the code.
Right. The code also sets out a number of best practice requirements for lease negotiation. How do you expect to see lease negotiations change as a result of the code?
So yes, part three of the code relates to best practice and lease negotiation. And as an aside, whilst the section has the title best practice, in RICS regulatory terms, the contents of the section are actually good practice, not best practice. But in this context, best and good practice appear to mean the same thing. Earlier, we touched on the RICS's expectations of a regulated surveyor in relation to best practice. But the key point for the surveyor is that they could be asked by the RICS to justify any departures from the specified best practice. So they have to treat it seriously. So how onerous is this best practice? It includes matters to be covered in the negotiations for the heads of terms and also matters to be considered in the preparation and negotiation of the lease itself. And whilst the code imposes no professional or regulatory obligations on the legal advisors, the best practice section may well have a trickle-down impact on the contents of commercial leases going forwards. And I say this because it may in part be because of surveyors' concerns to ensure compliance with the code, but also because the best practice section may over time come to be regarded as a fair and balanced statement of what should go in a commercial lease. And this will likely lead to tenants using it to support their negotiating position, and some landlords may see it as a reflection of a sensible commercial compromise and therefore acceptable to secure a deal. So it may assist in getting future commercial lease transactions over the line in a more efficient manner.
And can you talk me through the key aspects of this best practice?
So the best practice touches on all the main components of the commercial lease, and it comprises over 4 pages of the code. So the points I'm going to mention are just a snapshot of the issues. Prospective tenants should be told at the outset where the lease is to be contracted out of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, so that the tenant will have no statutory rights to hold over at the end of the contractual term, or to a renewal lease, or to compensation if the landlord successfully opposes the grant on particular grounds. The idea of this is that the tenant can obtain professional advice on what losing those rights means, again supporting the key principle that the parties are fully informed before they contractually commit to the new lease. Next point, unless the parties have agreed stricter conditions, the only conditions to a tenant's break should be payment of basic rent, giving up occupation, and leaving no subtenants or other occupiers that could interfere with what the landlord wants to do with the premises. And this is a fair reflection of what is usually agreed following the negotiation. So previously I said that the code doesn't say anything mandatory about the contents of break clauses, but it does have a best practice provision on this. The tenant doesn't have to comply, the surveyor doesn't have to comply with that. But ultimately, if they don't, the RICS may require them to justify why they haven't complied. And I will say at the end just a little bit about how I think surveyors can help themselves to make themselves better positioned if the RICS comes along to ask them to justify their position. On rent review, a definition of market rent should not result in a headline rent unless specifically agreed, such as in return for a financial inducement. And it has to be said that most leases these days do not seek to achieve this artificially high headline rent, a concept that goes all the way back to the 1990s. But most leases these days don't try to achieve that position for landlords. So this is a reflection very much of a typical lease these days. On service charge, in April 2019, the RICS's professional statement on commercial service charge went live. And the best practice in the code for leasing business premises asked the parties to have regard to the service charge statement, and that so far as practicable, the lease's service charge provision should conform to the statement's mandatory provisions and core principles. And the cross-reference to this other recently published statement on service charge is a logical step on the RICS's part to bring together their various regulatory documentation. When a tenant assigns a lease, it can be required to provide an authorised guarantee agreement guaranteeing the party to whom it assigned. And this agreement, known for short as an AGA, is a creature of statute which allows a landlord to require it even if it is unreasonable. Now, whilst the code's best practice stance that the AGA should only be required if reasonable may appear to run counter to the statutory purpose, it is a reflection of what is increasingly encountered in negotiated leases. The basic code position on reinstatement of tenants' alterations is that this should only be required if reasonable. But we do know that there will be landlords who will want greater control, and this is reflected in the code's acknowledgement that the heads of terms can provide for a more onerous obligation in relation to reinstatement on the tenant's part. Leases increasingly cater for damage that is not covered by the landlord's property insurance, and the best practice provides for the catering for uninsured damage in leases. Finally, the best practice extends to consideration of including green lease provisions and moderating the landlord's control of which assessor should provide an energy performance certificate for the tenant, which of course is increasingly important today because of the requirements of the minimum energy efficiency standards. So in my view, that summary of some of the key points of best practice is really a good reflection of a well-balanced negotiated lease in today's market, and its increased status will bolster tenants' arguments for including its suggestions in the lease.
All right. And what are the penalties for non-compliance?
So the penalties for breach of a mandatory provision can be quite serious for a regulated surveyor or firm, with a potential fine of potentially several thousand pounds and reputational harm. And even with the best practice, there may be professional embarrassment if the RICS requires the surveyor to justify non-compliance with the code's best practice. So as I said several times previously, it has to be taken seriously by the surveyor.
Yeah. And just in terms of having been a member of the working party, what sort of feedback have you been privy to? I mean, what's the general sense from practitioners?
I think we've had lots of feedback in the course of the process, going backwards and forwards, with people thinking it's too pro-land or too pro-tenant. I think we feel like we've ended up in a situation where it is a balanced document. It perhaps deals with some of the things that were perceived to be too tenant-friendly in the old code, and it is now a balanced document. In terms of the feedback, now it's been launched, I think it's too soon to tell. I've had no specific feedback myself in terms of the last week or so since it's been launched. I think it's unlikely there will be many objections to the mandatory elements, which are not especially onerous. Some landlords will not agree with some aspects of the best practice, but I do think that we've tried to sort of give options in that regard, and with an increasing need to have voids filled to provide income and deal with rates liability, I think the types of compromises that are reflected in the code may well need to be agreed in practice anyhow on a negotiation.
Okay. And there's 6 months now between publication of the document and it coming into force in September. How should professionals be gearing up for its implementation?
So I think there are some important things that surveyors should be doing at this stage. They can't just ignore this. They should be checking that their forms of heads of terms are compliant with the checklist in the code. Alternatively, they can get their systems ready to use the new template proposed by the code. Surveyors should be having discussions with their legal advisors and their clients over whether approaches need to be changed to lease negotiations and the contents of leases. And I mentioned earlier about surveyors being well placed if the RICS comes along to ask them to justify a position. I think there is some logic for a surveyor or their employers or the property company to create a record where a particular client or employer of a surveyor has a policy approach for a lease issue, including an explanation of the good reasons behind the approach. It could be tenant mix in a particular shopping centre, for example. So if the surveyor is required to justify a decision or action by the RICS, which may not accord with the code's best practice, but it's clear that there's a policy that their particular employer or client adopts, I think it will make it easier for the surveyor to justify the approach they've taken if the RICS asks them to do so.
Okay. So food for thought there in terms of how to proceed over the next few months. Warren Gordon, many thanks indeed for joining me today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Sarah Jackman. For more information on the new code, see the EG archive at egi.co.uk.